from Santa Barbara, California. The Timeless Voyager with Bruce Stephen Holmes. Talk radio for the new age. Interviews with well-established professionals in the fields of New Age philosophy, holistic healthcare, energy healing, psychic phenomena, and extraterrestrial encounters. And now, Bruce Stephen Holmes, the Timeless Voyager.
Hello, everyone. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio. With us today, Jonathan Young. He is the curator of the Joseph Campbell Archives and Library, and that is located at the Pacifica Institute here in Southern California. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
It's nice to be here and to meet you, Bruce.
All right. Now, you are the what does the curator do?
Well, I'm an archivist. I've spent a great deal of time at the Campbell Homes in New York City and Honolulu to go through Professor Campbell's papers and books and personal notes and organize them and bring them to Santa Barbara so that they will be available for future scholarship.
Who is Joseph Campbell and why do we have to archive his material?
Well, he is the best known comparative mythologist of this century. Best known now because of six programs that he did with Bill Moyers on public television in the late 1980s. I'm getting lost in my decades here. Actually, Bill Moyers did two programs with him in the early 80s and had such an overwhelming response that he raised the money to do the longer series, which was first broadcast in 1987, called The Power of Myth.
All right, now, we talked a little bit about Joseph Campbell. How did he develop his interest then in mythology?
Well, as a little boy, he was interested in cowboys and Indians. Well, actually, his father took him to the Wild West show at Madison Square Garden. And this was a profound experience for young Joseph Campbell, who was 6 or 7 at the time, and he decided that he was an Indian, and it took him a while to realize that he wasn't an Indian. Now, that story in and of itself is not unusual for a young boy. What was different for Joseph Campbell was that he began reading all of the available books for children about Indians. By the age of 11, he had read everything in the public library for children in the area and was admitted to the adult stacks and began reading through everything that was available, including these extensive ethnographic reports prepared by the Smithsonian. He became a scholar before he was out of his teens and was able to write extensive essays on the nuances and details of Native American lore in his high school literary magazine. So it was the intensity of his scholarship that really set him aside from the average young man interested in American Indians.
So this started with American Indians. Are the archives basically all American Indian, or?
We have an enormous amount of material on Native American mythology. His books and papers, the books have extensive margin notes where he is comparing the stories from North America with mythologies from other continents. But that was just the beginning of his extensive scholarship. By college, his interest had turned to European mythology, with particular emphasis in the Grail stories, the Round Table, and all of those troubadour adventures.
He was really on a quest for truth.
He was, and he was interested in the comparisons between these stories. Customarily, mythologists or anyone working in literary scholarship specialize. They go into some area and make that their life work. But he saw that there were these great similarities around the world in the stories that shape our religious interests.
You are not just a curator.
Well,
you are a clinical psychologist, is that correct?
That's right, and I teach in the graduate programs at Pacifica. We have master's and doctoral programs in clinical psychology. With this interdisciplinary emphasis, that is, we include the study of mythology and religious studies and art history and other humanities with the study of psychology, believing that to truly understand human experience, one has to break out of the social sciences.
Yeah. Now we talked a little bit the other day when you gave me a tour of the area. I mentioned that psychology has kind of become the bridge between science and, let's say, non-science at this point. And that's very important, isn't it?
Well, psychology, being the systematic observation of human experience, is going to try, and mainstream psychology does try, to quantify, to study, to make as rational as possible, or develop principles and a research database that explains and predicts human consciousness. But there are so many limits to what that kind of empirical effort can do. And beyond that is the mystery, the wonder, the magic of what human experience really entails. In the practice of psychology, that is the healing arts within psychotherapy, the average practitioner is aware that the science of psychology barely touches what comes up in clinical sessions.
So now a very important term, the healing arts, because when the layperson thinks of psychology, all they basically think of is someone has a problem. And they go to someone who is a psychologist or a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist to help work out an issue. That you refer to as the healing arts.
Which within the field of psychology is not the majority. The area of research psychology is much larger than the applied part, clinical psychology and psychotherapy. But you're right, the public perception is that a psychologist is a therapist that someone goes and talks to. And that therapist uses the whole research background of the field of psychology and draws on whatever else will inform an understanding of this human predicament that presents itself within a counseling office. That's poetry, art, mythology, religion, whatever suggests or reveals something about human consciousness.
It used to be said that the arts, music certainly, and art reflected, and of course drama, reflected the level or the state of consciousness of the human at that time. It almost seems that psychology now is also reflecting this, because we're seeing as the consciousness of the masses changes, as the awareness moves, psychology is constantly bridging that. And for example, we have lots of psychologists now who practice many, many different types of alternative therapies. They use new decision therapy. They use channeling. They use astrology. The psychologists seem to make use of all of these tools that have been termed quote-unquote new age devices or something.
One thing that Joseph Campbell was very strong on was seeing that the great sacred narratives, which is what we call mythology, these great stories from all over the world, had not only religious functions, cosmological functions, as he put it, and not only social functions to suggest good ways to live, right livelihood, and the rest of it, but psychological functions. That is, they were symbolic systems to help people integrate themselves emotionally.
Now, this stuff is not new. That's what's important here. So we're just kind of like, I don't know, let's say a rebirthing of the masses again, where we're moving, I guess, away from the objective reality and moving more towards the subjective reality now?
Well, people that are fond of mythology and what is happening lately would probably say that we're recovering from 100 years or more of only seeing the objective, that is, only seeing the factual, historical aspect of things, and in particular, these sacred stories, that mythologies were seen as mere history, which gets us into the confusion between the term myth and, you know, as illusion or lie or falsehood.
I'm just going to ask you that. All right.
Because
up until this point, if someone said, oh, it's just a myth, do we have a misunderstanding of the word myth then? There must be, because people say it's a falsehood, or it didn't work. It's not something that really happened.
Right. Just a myth with that kind of dismissive tone. Yes, if myth is taken as history, it's not very good. It's not very good history. If we're talking about actual events, and that there are all these supernatural things that happen in mythology, surely a reader says, this couldn't have really happened. This person couldn't have taken to flight or come back from the dead or whatever amazing, miraculous
thing. What is your stance on that?
That it's all symbolic, that it is psychological. Right. And this is what Campbell said. Joseph Campbell was saying, we've entirely misunderstood this idea of resurrection from the dead, which, by the way, was not a uniquely Christian story. It had many versions before that in that area and in other areas of the world. This is about spiritual regeneration. This is about the fact that contact with eternity, something sacred, can renew life, and you can come back from depression or from a dead experience, metaphorically speaking. And the virgin birth was not about someone being born without human sexuality. It was about something wholly stemming from a pure part of one's soul. That when we took these things as mere historical facts, we completely miss the true magic, the symbolic depth of the story.
Now, there are a lot of people who don't like what you just said, okay? And that's because they want to believe in super, and we use the word supernatural, meaning that anything can happen. Is your stance that basically none of this stuff can happen and we're only looking at symbol and there has really never been anything more than someone talking about something that really never happened?
I think the symbolic reading of these stories is so exciting, is so miraculous in its ability to transform human experience, that I'm not too fascinated with so-called supernatural events, that is, people truly flying or coming back from the dead or having amazing physical healings. I think some of those things are possible, but it's almost a different category of mind for me.
Okay, so what we're really looking at is we're looking at an angle of study, which is yours. And certainly because you are the archivist for Joseph Campbell, obviously this would be your interest.
That's my interest as someone who's always been interested in mm-hmm. stories, and in particular the psychological application of stories, which for me didn't actually begin with the study of Joseph Campbell's ideas. In my doctoral work, I studied with a man named Rollo May, who had written extensively on the psychological application of mythology, particularly in a well-known book called Love and Will, which was published in 1969. And so I could see that there was this way to understand the mysteries of human consciousness by seeing these ancient stories, timeless, which is appropriate for this program, these timeless stories.
Right.
That is, what we had were the subtle mysteries of human consciousness played out in dramas where they were represented by the gods, and the gods would have these different interactions, and what we really had were very hard to understand events within the human unconscious that were projected into these great stories.
What is unique then about Joseph Campbell's approach to mythology?
His special emphasis was on comparison, and he was able, through the incredible effort of his scholarship, to master the mythic systems of every continent. No other scholar, with perhaps one exception, Messia Eliade of the University of Chicago, these two are the only ones that have tried to take on world stories on this scale. Because he was able to understand them in such detail, and be, in essence, a specialist in so many areas, he could see that there were enormous similarities. And so his great, most famous book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, that was published in 1949, suggests that there is one great story, the monomyth. He actually got that term from James Joyce, that he had done some earlier scholarship on, that this story of the human being setting out in life and going into an adventure, hearing a call, being drawn into a series of lessons, and then coming back with something to contribute to the community that was new and fresh and that stemmed from this adventure, this was his suggestion, that this basic pattern occurs all over the world.
Which, I guess, says to us that since the pattern is being repeated, this must be the truth.
Well, it is a kind of truth.
I mean,
a mythic truth,
right?
Yes,
but saying that, if so many indigenous cultures that have covered a long span of time can talk about the same issues over and over again with no communication. These people, we know that the Greeks, for instance, did not have much communication with us because of a span. We know what they thought about, but they had no idea what we were thinking about.
For these patterns to recur.
And to be rediscovered, that's what I'm saying, to be rediscovered over and over and over again means that there must be something in the human consciousness that is on the level of the DNA or the RNA, which is programmed into us.
There is some kind of universality. It is a mystery to me how it is passed along or how what we have in common. One of Campbell's suggestions was that we do share a biological reality. We have a certain experience of being in a human body and a certain experience of living on this earth. And we have that whether we're growing up in Europe or our ancestors are growing up in Europe or growing up in New Guinea, that there are certain basic shared experiences, and that is the area from which these great stories stem, and that would explain these shared concerns and experiences would explain why the stories are so similar.
Now, how does the understanding of metaphor open up mythology?
Well, metaphor is the key to it all. That is the understanding that these are symbolic lessons, that we need not merely take these stories literally, that there is much more to it than that. It was interesting that Joseph Campbell often referred to a radio interview where he realized that the interviewer didn't know what metaphor meant. And he bantered back and forth with him, and the interviewer finally said, well, okay, a metaphor is to say Joe Smith runs like a deer. And Campbell replied, no, that's not a metaphor. A metaphor is to say Joe Smith is a deer. And that is the symbolic reading, and it explains why people get confused about myth and think that it has to do with illusion or falsehood. Because, of course, we know Joe Smith is not a deer. But it is a very powerful way to suggest how fast Joe Smith can run to say he is a deer. And that symbolic language explains the sacred. He would comment, Campbell would say, well, the trouble with Yahweh is he thought he was God, that there are masks of God, that is, each tribal culture has a way of suggesting the sacred, and each group believes, okay, that's God. Comparative studies suggest, well, whatever God is must be behind that, must be behind all these different local variations. It's not to suggest there isn't God, but that this is only just a glimpse.
So we're looking at masks, right? These are all masks. They're all masks.
They're all masks.
We take all the masks off, we come to a new mask.
Perhaps, and we take that one, we go beyond that. But to suggest, in fact, he suggests in one of his...
Is this because of linear thinking, right?
Well, it's because of linear and concrete thinking that if we...
Because it couldn't possibly be that difficult to discover the God.
Well, it's difficult to get past the debris of one's own mind and mm-hmm. one's own culture.
Right.
It is profoundly simple behind that.
Right, that's what I mean. God would never have made this that difficult an experience. Well, if indeed he made anything at all. All right, now... Let's talk about... I'm thinking to myself already. I'm thinking of the story of Superman. So Clark Kent is Superman. This was never a story of Superman. This was the story of Clark Kent.
It was interesting, and I don't know much about it. There was some conversation that several scholars had, and Campbell was one of them. David Miller, a professor at Syracuse, was another, and Rollo May was in this conversation. And it was about the differences in mythology between Superman and Batman. Whether someone was more drawn to the supernatural fantasy or to one that had a great deal of ingenuity in it, but not the supernatural powers. And I wish I had a transcript of that conversation, because it does suggest that even in popular culture, great mythic themes are being played out.
Of course, I'm thinking to myself, all of our movies, all of our books, everything, the television shows, it's our own mythology, isn't it?
And one of the things that happens to people that participate in popular culture, watch the TV shows, read the comic books, whatever, is that they are momentarily, at least, caught up in that great archetypal role. They are the hero for that moment.
All right, now let's examine a standard scenario. Matlock, all right? We know that Matlock is this incredible attorney. We actually know that it is another gentleman. His name is not Ben Matlock, really. He's an actor. But we can lose sight of that, can't we? And isn't that how what mythology is all about? It's losing sight of the fact that there was someone who was an actor. When I say acting, I mean someone was doing something, and after a period of time, we forgot who that was. We forgot that it was Andy Griffith.
Right. Now, in drama, that's called the willing suspension of disbelief.
Right. But the willing suspension of disbelief can become, if what I'm trying to say is that as time goes on, when the willing suspension of disbelief becomes unimportant, and who Andy Griffith was and who was Matlock, and after a while, what's important is the story of Matlock, and pretty soon that's what Matlock looks like. That's who Matlock was. Pretty soon Matlock exists, and Andy Griffith, we don't even remember his name.
And it's just as well, because whatever the message, and
right.
I'm not sure that Matlock is too profound, although there are, and I hadn't thought of this until this moment, yeah. But let's stay with Matlock for a moment. If we want to participate in this universal pattern of energy or whatever it may be, it is useful to allow ourselves that participation. Carl Jung called this the participation mystique, where you allow yourself to go into that and, okay, believe that is Matlock, and also believe he has infinite wisdom, when in fact we know he has good script writers.
But he does have infinite wisdom, doesn't he?
He does.
And he always, this is just, in all the great mythology this happens. I mean, we could talk about 007 if we want to, but I'm just saying this.
Great powers, magical powers.
For some strange reason, when no one else has been able to come up with the answer, the mythological character comes up with it, and he always or she always has the right answer, rises above every possible problem, and in the end, everyone who is associated learns a lesson, including the person watching or reading it.
Especially the person watching right. and reading it.
So, I mean, isn't that basically what we're talking about?
Yes, and Matlock, I think, is a good example of what we might call the sage archetype, the wise old one, who often presents himself very modestly. Now, Joseph Campbell was interested in Celtic mythology. In fact, in his graduate studies, was writing on areas of the Grail story, particularly having to do with a Fisher King. Now, a key figure in the Grail mythology is Merlin, the wise old magician, who often presents himself as kind of a bumbling fool, sometimes transforms himself into a hermit or a beggar or something like that. And the person who passes by this very unassuming character in the story will miss the great lesson. So we're constantly being reminded, don't fall for impressions, because the great wisdom can be anywhere. And so through his very unassuming presence, he is able to solve problems and mostly teach lessons of great wisdom. And I think in a very modest way, Matlock is kind of a Merlin character, and we can pick up on timeless mythology by watching this TV show.
Well, I think the point I was making, and I was, of course, not, you know, making Matlock into this phenomenal, incredible story, but or group of stories, episodes, but I think what I was pointing out, and I'm sure that everyone's gotten it by now, but I'd love to repeat it, is that we have our own mythology. We're developing our own mythology. There's no telling where this might go. We have no idea, because if indeed every culture pretty much lives the same way, we are all human beings, then I would suspect that hundreds and hundreds of years from now, or thousands of years from now, if the planet is still... or if people can live on the planet, we will be looking at mythology. Or they will be looking at mythology. Or, in a matter of fact, I believe that we will all be looking at the same story that we developed thousands of years ago.
It's the same story, and yet there are applications and lessons for each historical moment. And to stay with Matlock a moment further, because it's a marvelous example you've brought in, not only is it a television show with familiar actors in it. Not only is it a pleasant little story about a lawyer solving problems, if we get past the fact that these are actors, and not only is it sort of a timeless pattern of a mythic drama, if you will, but it has great psychological lessons. We're not only reacting to someone on the television screen. We're reacting to the part of our inner world that is Matlock-like. That's a tongue twister, which is to say we have a...
We're creating an entire...
We create a psychology on the spot here. We have a part of ourselves that is a canny, shrewd, unassuming, wise lawyer defender. And to watch that show is, in some small way, to access that part of our human endowment through this participation. And that's part of why a show like that is popular.
Boy, I can see where this is going, because then again, what we really are seeing is then, obviously, all that we're seeing on television, everything, is affecting us, isn't it? And
profoundly.
So, I mean, very profoundly. So that our mythology, the mythology that is teaching us wisdom, live a good life, all of these things, is going to affect a large number of people, just as the mythology that is teaching us that we need not follow rules. Some of the programs that have graphic violence and incredible storylines, which are certainly detrimental to human development, these are also our mythology, aren't they?
Yes, it's hard to know how to react to the popularity of the very violent programs and movies. Certainly there is violence in the world, and we have to, through our art, even popular culture, we have to learn how to grapple with that very real aspect of modern life. I'm not sure that the presentations we see help us grapple, whether they give us lessons.
Well, I'm going to say they don't.
Yeah, I think they may have a numbing effect, that they only terrorize us further. At the same time, we do need to be aware of that part of life, although we probably get plenty of it on the news.
Did Joseph Campbell draw personal lessons from mythology?
Yes, I don't think he set out to do that at the beginning of his career. He got a job teaching at Sarah Lawrence College in the 30s. He had been unemployed for a number of years during the Depression, and had done a great deal of personal reading that really formed the foundation for his lifelong scholarship. But this college was a very innovative place at the time that allowed students to design their own programs and had a lot of interdisciplinary work that was very unusual for its time. And these were the best and brightest of American women college students. And they kept insisting on personal applications for these stories that Professor Campbell was telling. They were interested in relevance. What has this got to do with me? And he had to look at every mythic story he was teaching and find the personal applications, or his students just wouldn't leave him alone. And in his later writings, he credits the influence of his Sarah Lawrence students with the fact that his books have been rather popular, because people could see how it applied to their lives and that it wasn't just scholarship on stories from far away and long ago.
How about an example?
Well, I think in the Grail story, where that was of special interest to Campbell, you could say, well, here was a nation that was organized around the search for the Holy Grail, which seems very fanciful at this time. But if you take it on a personal level, this is the search for the sacred within your life, that the first part of life may be taken up with practical concerns, raising a family, succeeding at some kind of work. And then there is the calling, some interest in something religious or spiritual or artistic, something that calls from a deeper place, the Holy Grail, if you will, that says, come find me, and that we are needed in that way. So that's a way that a piece of mythology from Europe, in this case, can be seen on a personal level.
A lot of people, and certainly I see tremendous connection between mythology and mysticism. Is there a connection?
Well, Campbell was always emphasizing the mystical implications of each and every story. Some of his university colleagues from different parts of the world would criticize him for always emphasizing that aspect of the story. But he thought that these were great teaching stories, and that they always had mystical implications, and that what they showed in a kind of spiritual roadmap, if you will, was how to come into a larger sort of consciousness, to how to reach that mystical level, that there were a number of adventures that the protagonists of these mythic stories had, and the boon, the payoff, the advantage, the lesson that they got always was to have a kind of mystical awareness.
So am I getting the idea that Joseph Campbell himself believed in the mystical experience?
Yes, and people would ask him what his devotional practice was. Did he pray? Did he meditate? Mm-hmm. He said, I underline sentences, which was a very droll way of saying that you don't have to follow the traditional paths.
Or it's none of your business.
I think he really did have mystical experience by way of scholarship. He was really following the way of the philosopher. I see you surrounded with all of your technical equipment here, and perhaps your mystical form has something to do with all of these electronics. I think it's different for each person, and he was trying to say, you don't have to necessarily sign up at a certain temple to have it. There are lots of ways for this to saturate life.
Now, in the Vedic scriptures, they refer to this as dharma, one's dharma. One's dharma is the way one's takes the path that one has, I guess, decided to be on. And as long as they stay with their particular route, it will bring them to the mystical experience or the, development of their self, their essential nature, or the awakening of the God within them, whatever terms you want to use. And so when he said, I underline sentences, he was not joking.
That's right. That's right. And in the West, it's familiarly called a vocation. That is, there is some calling, and if you put your hand to that with all your worth, there will be more than a practical outcome. You will have a sense of place and belonging, and the radiance, the sacredness of life will come to you.
Well, a lot of people lost sight of the fact that there are two methods of enlightenment. I mean, there's not just the method of the... I was going to say that there is the householder, which is always lost. Everyone always forgets. They're always thinking of the monk or the hermit, the person who lives alone out in a cave. But there was always the root of the householder. As a matter of fact, the householder was always a very strong way for a person to move in this tremendous development that perhaps is mythological, but certainly is mystical.
When Joseph Campbell would say, follow your bliss, some people criticize that as if it was about, hedonism or, living in hot tubs or something. He was talking about a very devout spiritual path that was not without its hardships. It was really coming out of the East, where you follow the thing that calls you, and certainly it has to be pleasurable. You have to find it attractive, or it never could hold your fascination for a lifetime. But if you will follow that, it will take you through great hardships, and ultimately to a kind of radiant experience of life.
And that is the point, isn't it? That you just cannot have some type of linear experience. This definitely has to be an experience that is whole. It's a holistic experience.
And it's a real spiral, to use the metaphor, to break out of the linear metaphor. It goes downward. There is a dark night of the soul. There is certainly a great deal of time that is spent in close contact with the unconscious, where you really don't know what's going on or why you're doing what you're doing, and you can come out the other side where things are fuller and clearer.
I hesitate to talk about the tip of the iceberg, but let's talk about sacred art objects.
Well, beginning in 1972 with a book called The Mythic Image, Campbell was able to show what he had always been talking about in his books, which was that the mythic story was best presented in a mythic image, whether that was a statue or a tapestry or some kind of an art object, that in fact all of this is first of all visual. Carl Jung noted the great parallels between mythology and dreams, that dreams were sort of a personal mythology, a personal experience of these mythic patterns, and myths were very much like shared dreams, that it's kind of a big dream we all got together on. And this is all visual, because, of course, dreams don't come with guidebooks. They're series of images we see in our night's sleep. And primarily the mythic experience is a visual experience, and the story comes later. The story explains the origins of these gods or whatever the statue or painting may be about. First of all, there's a kind of visionary experience where the image comes, and that is the most sacred and, if anything, the most pure representation of the holy.
Now, people lose sight of this constantly, the fact that we are all sharing an incredible amount of information that seems to be, or we think is personal all the time. Everyone thinks these are my personal thoughts, this is my personal idea, this is my personal feeling, no one else is having this feeling, and yet it seems like all of us are like little radio receivers doing nothing more than receiving the great, this is the big personal feeling, and these are the thoughts and the feelings, and they're not yours.
In the West, there is this emphasis on the individual, as if we're each having this unique
experience. Each one of
experience.
Us is an island, right?
That's right. When, in fact, as Carl Jung suggested, we're directly connected to some kind of collective unconscious, some kind of collective psyche that we're all participating in. I suppose in the West, the clearest example of that is what we call culture. Well, we're in this thing together. I mean, we wear similar clothes. We're not walking around in clothes that look like they came out of Tibet. So I didn't invent this look I have. I'm participating
right.
in something. And
as a matter of fact, if you don't participate, you are then looked upon as being, and we of course we use the word different, but you're not also you're not acceptable. And the thought that happens when you choose not to look the same is that you have different thoughts, you have different agendas, you have different feelings, when in reality, of course, that's not true. It's almost impossible, isn't it?
With all this emphasis on being creative and being unique, perhaps the important thing is how much we're really all in this together.
Right. Let's talk then just for a moment about the relationship then between myth and ritual, because we're starting to talk about ritual now. After all, the way we dress, the fact that we all have cars, that we have radios, we have TVs, we eat certain types of dinners, we have pizza, that actually is ritual, isn't it, in a sense?
And
the way we in our culture respond to these things, that is sort of ritualistic.
That's right, and we're caught
even up... Even the Monday night football is ritualistic in the sense that it sets up a certain event.
And it's very shared. Now, those in the stadium are having a pretty direct experience of ecstatic worship, if you will, and the players are the ritual celebrants. But those, by extension, watching television get pretty ecstatic, too. So yes, we have living religion. Ritual is alive and well, but seldom acknowledged as such. And those games, of course, are pretty directly traceable back to Central American games that were Mayan and Inca and Aztec that had acknowledged ritual meaning. I mean, they were dedicated to the gods and a playing out of transcendent mysteries.
Let's for a moment break and go back for a moment on the term ritual. What is the purpose of ritual?
Well, ritual acts out the mythic story is the mental aspect of the ritual, and the ritual is the physical enactment of the story. So they are two sides of the same thing. If you are in...
Let's do that once more.
Okay. The mythic story is the mental representation of the ritual.
All right.
Okay. And the ritual is the physical enactment of the story. So they are two aspects or two manifestations of the same reality. And they both point beyond themselves.
All right, so would we say, coming back to Matlock, is the television show the ritual?
The television show is an enactment of the ritual, and then we could speculate that watching the television show is also part of the ritual.
All right.
But yes, the actors going through these scenes is an enactment of a ritual. Now, the myth that lies behind that, on a most superficial level, is the teleplay, is the script.
Right.
Okay. But on a deeper level, it is all of the cultural patterns, both conscious and unconscious, that those writers have drawn on.
Right, which we all share.
And then we're into the objective psyche, the collective unconscious that Carl Jung talked about.
How do we make decisions about what we like and don't like if it's all coming from the same place?
Well, there are variations because there are many archetypes. There are many great mythic stories. I think that our attention will be drawn to certain stories and certain characters in fiction, in television and films that speak to a certain part of our lives. That is, people that need to develop their maturity, their wisdom, might be drawn to Matlock. I don't want to give Matlock too much credit here, but the archetype that stands behind this television character is, at a certain point in a person's journey, an important thing to be studied, and I think that our attention will be drawn to that. At different points of life, at different times in the journey, I think we'll be drawn to different kinds of stories, and we'll watch different shows, see different films, and read different novels.
All right, now, how do you see the emergence of a real appreciation of mythic stories influencing, let's say, the evolution of consciousness? Because we've been talking a lot about these stories now. And what I don't mean to interrupt you because I know you have an important thing to say, but I want to say that, you know, we could have spent a lot of time on something that happened thousands and thousands of years ago, but I thought the relevance of talking about Matlock or the rituals of football were really important because I think people need to see that this is an ongoing and this is not time-oriented.
I think that the participation in watching television and watching rituals, I think the fascination with great moments in history, watching the inauguration of the president or something like that, which is the parallel to the crowning of the king in ancient times, shows that we are very hungry for ritual participation in this historical moment. We are longing for the mythic experience and that dimension. I think the incredible popularity of the Joseph Campbell interviews with Bill Moyers shows that people are not only interested in participating, but they're interested in understanding how we are living in myth. We are living in ritual, and if we were aware of that, it would be all the richer for us.
So we are all, in a sense, searching for the grail in our own way.
Very much so. We are all on that heroic adventure, and we are longing for the lessons that it will give us. And if we could be just a bit more conscious that that's what we're doing with our life energies, we could be even more open to what it can give us.
Are there any other people that you know carrying on the work with mythic stories and metaphor in the same spirit?
There are a few. We have a graduate institute. We are training people at the graduate level to be psychologists and study mythology and the personal applications of it. There are people working in the field. Robert Bly, who was very close to Campbell, has had a bestseller applying mythic stories specifically to male psychology. Sam Keen, who was a good friend of Joseph Campbell's, has had a bestseller with Fire in the Belly, again about male psychology. The whole movement in the goddess work that has been very popular both in academia and in popular books has addressed women's mythology. There is a great deal of work being done. There are new books by Joseph Campbell coming out that we have found in his papers and in the archives and that are going to be published. The interest in mythology has never been greater. Ironically, most of it traces to those programs on television, which reveal something about the power of the media. Programs like yours and others that are beginning to take certain ideas out of the arcane attic and bring them out into public media are being greeted with incredible popularity because the time is right.
You give frequent presentations on mythology, right?
I travel around the country talking not only about Joseph Campbell's ideas, but taking stories, some that he worked on and some others that are similar, and showing how the metaphoric meaning, the symbolic, figurative reading of a familiar fairy tale like, oh, Cinderella or the Frog King or Robin Hood or something like that, in fact, explains a great deal about how life can give us spiritual lessons.
Let's talk about folk stories having spiritual lessons.
Well, those examples, when we think about, I'll take off on Robin Hood because it was a popular movie a year or so ago. If if somebody looks at that just as an adventure story, they might miss the fact that this character, usually dressed in green, actually represents the forces of nature, and that there's an ancient tradition in...
He lived in the forest.
That's right. So it's really
about... He lived in harmony with the laws of nature.
Uh-huh. And okay. Not always in harmony with the community.
Right.
So that we are reminded that we need to be part of the wildness, that we need to be an outlaw at times if injustice prevails in life, that we have a higher calling, that we have to act in concert with others, that is, he had his merry band, that we're not alone. It always takes a communal effort to do anything important. I mean, there are lots of little insights in that story. It's more than just an adventure.
And of course, what's happening is most people only remember the one little scenario, namely that he stole from the rich and gave to the poor.
Which is a pretty important scenario.
So, of course it is, but I'm saying... Yeah. The rest of it is missed.
That's right. Well, and
he himself, for example, did not utilize those riches for his own greediness.
Right. It was always in the service of a higher principle. Even psychologically taking that perhaps internally there is some need to steal from the rich and give to the poor, that there is some part of our personality that gets all of our energy, or perhaps literally all of our money. Perhaps we only spend it on work, and some of it needs to go into creativity or religious interests or play, that there has to be a trickster, an outlaw, if you will, internally moving things around in our psychological community.
Are we talking about our little saboteur?
Well, the trickster, we like to call him.
The trickster. This stuff really ties in well with codependency issues now, doesn't it?
Well, yes. I think the whole awareness of codependency is quite a profound thing, and that people are learning that some things that have been going on in their families for generations are in fact not given truths and the only way to live, but just alternatives that can be considered.
How would mythology be used, for example, in some, just one codependency issue? We'll just take like one.
Well, you might take a story like Cinderella that seems like a long suffering story. Here is someone who is helping others, whose whole life is other directed, who is basically a slave to a role.
Okay.
And see that she can, through alignment with, I think in the story it was the birds and her fairy godmother, that is, she's not alone, there are spiritual guides available to each of us, whether in fantasy.
Well, they all helped, the horse.
All the animals.
The animals, they all became her vehicle.
So again, the connection with nature is a vital step in the movement of these stories. And through this, she can reconnect with something. Now, this is often taken as a courtship story, but I think that completely misses the point. This is about a woman connecting with her own regal inner qualities. Royalty in the old days was considered connected with deity. It was a sacred station in life. So through her diligence, she was able to connect with her own royal qualities and go into another place where she was no longer codependent. Now, stories like that have to be looked at very closely to show all that.
All right, we're running out of time. What do you see in the future of Campbell's work and ideas?
I mentioned that there are a number of additional books. Some have recently been published. His commentary on the work of James Joyce and Thomas Mann has recently come out. There is an authorized biography that's been published. There are some 9 additional books by Joseph Campbell that are to be published over the next few years. So people that are really interested in mythology from Campbell's viewpoint have a number of things to look forward to. And there are other people using our archives at Pacifica and using Campbell's work at a distance that are going to be continuing the work.
2 quick questions. I don't know if they have quick answers or not. Did you know Joseph Campbell?
I did. When he would come to Santa Barbara to do seminars, I would be his aide, pick him up at the airport and take him to meals and this sort of thing, which gave me a chance to spend time with him. And of course, I've gotten to know him even better since he's not with us, by way of his wife, working very closely with her to make sure that we understand how he used every book in his library.
How did you become the curator, and how did Pacifica become the site of the Campbell Archives.
He was very fond of our small college, came here often in the last two decades of his life, and when he died, he left a very short list of places he would consider to have as repositories for his papers and books, and we were very high on that list. He didn't consider any of the well-known places that were logical choices, like his college, which was Columbia University, or where he taught, Sarah Lawrence College. I think he wanted some place that understood the connection between mythology and psychology.
How did you become the curator?
Well, because of my deep fondness for him and my interest in mythology and psychology that goes back so long, of our faculty, I became the logical choice and I was available to do it. So I've been able to spend a great deal of time traveling and working with Jean Erdman, Campbell's widow, to put it all together.
And what is the nature of the materials that are available in the archives?
Well, we have thousands of books. We have his thousands of files, literally from a lifetime of reading and underlining sentences and taking notes from all those books that he was so diligent about. We have some art objects, goddess figures from ancient Europe, some Asian art images. We have then memorabilia, photographs and honorary doctorates and other awards he received. So really, the collection of scholarship and artifacts from his life are now located on our campus in Santa Barbara.
Thank you, Jonathan Young, for coming out here and being on the show today.
Thank you very much, Bruce.
All right, and thank you for tuning in to Timeless Voyager. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes, and I hope that your own personal voyage through life towards the development of your highest potential is a joyous and successful one. Thank you.